Welcome to the 12-Step Recovery Evolution podcast. Visit recoveryevolution.co.uk for more episodes, helpful resources and links to our social media. Also visit the site for information on how you can attend a future Zoom session or workshop live. Thank you.
Morning guys, good to see everybody. I'm going to start with a little bit of a warning. This is not like PG. This stuff is kind of like, I find if you've been in recovery a while, some of this stuff may be a little bit difficult to swallow. So I just want to say that I'm going to be reading from the big book. This family stuff and this dysfunction stuff, it's, you know what, this is what I tell people. If you begin to understand this, it's so overwhelming that if you don't wake up screaming, you're not understanding what we're saying. You can really see why most people choose to stay in denial. Now, when I say most people choose to stay in denial, if you're dysfunctional, that means you, and that you probably don't know what we're talking about. Now, don't say that to be, this is what I've learned over the decades that I've been doing this journey, is how dysfunctional I was as a human being, emotionally and mentally. And because of the real lack of information in the fellowship and in society as a whole, I feel one of the lucky ones that I did meet a couple of people on my journey that started to wake me up to this family dynamic and this dysfunction. And it is a very difficult journey. So like I say, the more you understand it, the more that you realise why people opt to try and learn to live with dysfunction rather than actually attempt the difficult journey of actually learning to heal from it. It's kind of like why, you know, people may not want to go to therapy, or they may go once or twice and then go, oh, that bloody therapist, they just talk about, and you can never actually get them to have any continuity in the journey. And they try and convince you it's because of the therapist. And again, sometimes that could be true. But usually it's this unconscious ego part of themselves that's sort of saying you don't want to pass that way because it's going to make you feel really uncomfortable going that way. Now, you can experience some of that discomfort by actually going to somebody that you love and care about and telling them the truth. Not in a shouty, screamy way, but in a considerate, kind, caring and loving way. Now that, for a dysfunctional person, is probably enough right there to give you a panic attack, the thought of actually doing that. So over the years, it's been my experience, and, you know, don't say this to condemn anybody, it's just been my experience, that most people actually swerve the step 9. And so most people that I meet that have been in long-term recovery that phone me up, or most people I talk to in short-term recovery that don't phone me up, but I get to talk to them, I'm usually checking about how their amends has gone. And in my experience, most people that I've met over the last few decades haven't made a very, what would be the word to use? Well, I don't think they've made much of an attempt on an actual proper step 9. And then again, I can hear the voices cry, who are you to say that we haven't done a step 9? And again, my question always is, have you forgiven your parents? Have a think about it. Have you forgiven your mum? Have you forgiven your dad? And the evidence of that is that you're quite comfortable to be able to go to them and tell them, because you've realised how sorry you are for the way that you've been responding to them most of your life, that you've been angry, that you've been inconsiderate, that you've been judgmental, that you've not really thought about their feelings, that you've not been patient, tolerant or kind to them because you've been constantly demanding that they fix whatever they did to you. And again, that's pretty deep stuff. We could go on a lot about that. So I wanted to say this, that this is not only, if when reading this, and I'm, again, it's always one of these things, it's so vast. It's like, you just want to think, where do you even start with this? Because again, you just want to give you the answer really, but there's no way of actually doing that. It's just trying to say, look, the first thing important is you can't change what you don't accept. So when I say things like to people, I don't think you've done a step nine, it's not that you're trying to make them feel bad or guilty or condemn them. You're just trying to get them to that they're willing to say, accept that they haven't actually made certain amends. And when they admit that, then you can start identifying it. And then you can, then they can start taking the action. Because some people say, you know, like, I forgive my mum or my dad or other people. And again, we've probably talked about that back in some of these other groups. But again, forgiveness doesn't stop you being dysfunctional. Forgiveness doesn't stop you being dysfunctional. Forgiveness doesn't stop them being dysfunctional. But hopefully it can take the sting out of it, which will allow you to start taking the correct action and making some changes in your life. Now, I think, again, people swerve that. So they may say, well, I've forgiven them. But when you actually start looking on the surface of the relationships, it's apparent that that's not quite true. One of my favourite ones that people say is, well, I've forgiven my parents, I hardly see them. And so there's a bit of evidence there. So if what, when reading through this, because this may seem like if you're new around and you've not really accustomed to this, or you've, remember before this step is another eight steps, because this is kind of around step nine sort of stuff. That, so if some of this stuff hits you and you feel guilt and you feel shame, the intention isn't to shame you or to make you feel guilty, but I'd get a pen and paper and I would write down what it is that we're saying that's making you feel the guilt, making you feel the shame. Because, see, I don't think guilt and shame are bad feelings. I don't think depression's a bad thing. I think, actual fact, I believe that's God talking to you myself. I believe when you actually feel shame, when you've actually been doing shameful things, that's a very healthy emotion. If you did shameful things and didn't feel it, then you'd be a psychopath. But if you feel guilty but you've actually done things where you are guilty, then I think that's a very healthy and a very good sense of actual fact, I'm doing something that I shouldn't be doing. See, I think depression is an emotional pain. Now, it is also a mental illness for some people, but I'd argue for very few that have a chemical imbalance in their brain that's caused by something that they're totally out of control of. There's something wrong in the meat of their brain, and that problem is altered state of mind to the normal what we'd be considered a normal kind of functioning mind. So when they take the antidepressants, that changes their mind back to kind of putting it into where it would be considered like normal parameters. So for them people, taking an antidepressant would actually be altering their mind back to where it should be. But for the people that are not got depression, but they feel depressed based on the way that they're behaving, the way that they're living, the way that they're thinking. Well, for them people, when they take a drug, that becomes a altering your mind, a drug that alters your mind away from what's normal. And so that, because I think that depression is telling you that you need to change the way that you're being. And again, I think that's a healthy emotion, but it's very badly misunderstood and very badly interpreted. So when I feel guilty, when my conscience, when my innermost self feels guilty, and I capture that in my infantry, I have a look at it. And then I say, am I guilty of doing something wrong that I need to promptly admit? And sometimes my physical self, or I might be angry at a person. No, I ain't guilty. They did this, they did that. He's like, man, maybe you need to phone somebody else. And then I phone somebody else and say, they did this and I did that. And they go, oh, mate, that sounds like you're a little bit out of order there. And I'm like, that's why I feel guilty, because I am guilty. And if I keep arguing that I'm not guilty, I feel bad and I keep feeling bad. And then I phone someone else up and then someone else up and then someone else up and someone else up. And I keep phoning people up. And when I'm sitting next to you on the bus, I'm telling you what an arsehole the other person is. And I keep on trying to convince everybody in the world that they're wrong because I feel bad and they made me feel bad. And then eventually someone says, but you, I know they were wrong, but the way that you're responding to it's wrong, and that's why you're feeling guilty. And then I accept that maybe it's me, and then I make the amends, and then I feel better. Funny that, isn't it? So the guilty feeling is my conscience, I believe. The feeling of shame is my conscience, I believe. And I believe that this whole spiritual process, he's trying to say to me, look, you keep rejecting yourself, your higher self. Because when you feel guilty, when you feel hurt, when you feel shameful, you're misinterpreting it. You're misinterpreting your own emotions. So then you start trying to deny it, trying to escape it. Or at the extreme, you start trying to anesthetize yourself. You start taking drugs so you feel better. But really, if you changed the way that you think and start dealing with some of them issues and putting them back, you'd feel better. Now, look, I know you're trying to make it as simple as I can, and it is a lot more complicated than that. We probably need a lot more time to dig deeper into it and go to a deeper dive of it. And again, we'd like to do workshops on this family stuff. But you kind of know, don't you, that if you have an argument with your family, even if you're right, it just doesn't feel nice. And it doesn't feel nice until you put it right. And I think, again, that's the universe. That's you know, evolution, that's kind of trying to promote us to be in well-being. Now, it can be difficult when they are actually wrong, and the big book says they're quite often wrong. And sometimes, you know, you can't let somebody keep coming in your house that's stealing from you or hitting you or abusing you and treating you bad. So, you know, we can't all be the Waltons, and not every relationship in our life is going to be wonderful and everybody's going to be happy and in love, because that's just not the world I live in anyway. So some people, I've got that bad feeling in my family because I just can't carry on in the behavior. But it doesn't mean I hold resentment to them or aggression to them or, you know, negative towards them, but it hurts. And I, you know, sometimes when you don't want that hurt, you can kind of also then be a people pleaser. We can kind of let people abuse us because we don't want the confrontation. So like I say, it gets a little bit deeper, and I'm trying not to go too far into it. And I didn't really even plan on going this far down the road, but I just wanted to lay a bit of foundation that, What I'm going to read here, that it's going to be about the family, and there's probably going to be hurt in there. But the purpose of this is to try and, you know, I'm trying not just to take pot shots. I'm trying to shoot into the heart. And again, the heart that I believe as a spiritual person isn't that fleshy thing in your chest. It's that gut level feeling. It's weird deep inside your gut that this spirituality is saying, this is where you connect with the spirit. This is the center of your being. This is where your consciousness begins. And we want to see what shit is being laid on your conscience to stop you listening to yourself. So people say to me, they say, oh, that's just your opinion. I'm like, what's your gut tell you? I'm only trying to be in tune with my gut. I'm only trying to be in tune with my conscience. I spend all my time doing all this spiritual stuff, but ultimately it's only to listen to my conscience, to my innermost self, to my gut, because that's where I believe God's talking to me. I believe that's where the universe is trying to guide me into what's right and wrong, what's good and bad. What does your gut tell you? And they always say, well, yeah, but, you know, I don't want to think that's it. And he's like, so ultimately we're all going against ourselves when we're not listening to our own conscience. But a lot of our conscience has been anesthetized. One, because we've become ignorant to it, because we've never learned how to listen to it, and that's the job of our parents, was meant to help you connect with your conscience. Because that's happening in all of us, I believe. You know, a conscience is at that gut level feeling. It's not people telling your conscience what to think. Your conscience is always there, but how you learn to interpret it is the job of your parents, humanity, spiritual teaching, scriptures, and all that. It's trying to tell you, look, you're either going to listen to your head or you're going to listen to your gut. But if you can get your head filled with good information, it'll probably be listening to its gut. And when you get your head in line with your heart, which is your gut, you're probably going to be rock and rolling in this world and be in line with the universe. So that's what this is sort of, I can see, it's this, how do you get your head in line with your heart? So what we're doing at the moment is we're aiming at your head, but we're hoping that this is going to get to your heart. And so we're not trying to get you to follow anybody other than yourself, your conscience, your own conscience. Let each man and woman be guided by their own conscience. But it's something you have to learn to be able to do. And so I think anything that's teaching you anything other than that, I wouldn't listen to it, to tell the truth. Now, so if you feel guilty, if you feel shameful, just write it down, because that's something that you may need to look at. Now, when you're talking to people and they respond angrily to you and they say, you're making me feel guilty, I feel you're condemning me, it's like, mate, that's already in you. In actual fact, don't be blaming me for that. I'm only the mirror. I'm only reflecting what's in you. Because if you don't feel guilty and don't feel shameful, you're going to not even bother mentioning anything to me, because it's not in you. And really, the goal is to get it out of you if it is in you. So that when you're in situation, because if you hold resentment to your family for what they've done to you, or you feel guilty because of what you've done to them, that's going to come between you. And we're all going to dance around it. And when we don't dance around it, then we start attacking each other. So when you start removing that, you start getting closer, because you're not feeling guilt, shame, or anger, or frustration, or despair when you're around them. So your response is kind of like the sign. When you actually work in this program, you're kind of looking for the fruit. So you do you do infantry, but then infantry needs to turn into amends. And then we can see if the amends is working by what's happening in your relationships and what's happening in your life. Are you starting to feel better about being around certain people? Because you kind of know that, you know, when you've forgiven them, because they carry on being an arsehole, but you don't care anymore. You know that when you go over a fear, because you're in the fearful situation, but you don't feel the fear. That's what we're looking for, isn't it? Is, you know, how do I be in these relationships without the trauma of my own emotions? Because really, you know, look, I'm not that keen on flying on planes, but I honestly don't believe the plane's going to crash. I'm not actually frightened of the plane. I'm frightened of the way I feel on the plane. You know, I don't like going in like massive rooms of people, but it's not the massive rooms of people I'm afraid of. It's the way I feel about going. I'm frightened of them feelings. But the good news is them feelings are in me. And if I can take responsibility for them, if I can accept them and then start breaking them down, I can start removing them feelings. And then when I go in that massive room or go on that plane or go in that scary situation, I'm not going to feel that. But what I'm afraid of is what I feel. So if you do feel bad when we're talking about this, try and capture that, because I think this is the most important information, what we're about to talk about in recovery. And I honestly believe this is really getting missed, that most people I've met never really do a step 9. And I think that's sad, because this is really where the miracle happens. So I'm going to start on page 82. It's probably going to do a bit of reading. I've rattled on quite a lot already. But on pages 82, we're looking at Into Action. Now, this is about the family. So this isn't, even though we're looking at you, we're actually talking about, you know, look, if you think about it, so alcoholics and addicts are selfish people. Now, no one likes to really, you know, we say this stuff. I kind of like it on the news at the minute. They're saying, you know, there's 800 people died today. But then they stop for a minute and say, that's not just a number. That's Sally from the post office died. Jim from the garage died, who's got a family. Aunt Betty died, who's got three nieces and nephews. Fred died, who was on the frontline nurse, and his family love him very much. And I kind of like that. So when we're talking about making amends and we're talking about, you know, doing step nine, we're talking about people's mums. We're talking about people's dads. We're talking about children. We're talking about spouses. But when we're such selfish people that only consider ourselves, again, that's not a judgment. That's a symptom of this terrible illness. Now, what I think makes addiction so terrible that it destroys relationships. The greatest thing that humans want in their life is relationships. Yet addiction destroys it, and we become very lonely, embittered people. And that's really not what I believe God intended. So even though this is about you, try and think about the other people in your life as we're reading it. Because I think most of the fellowship really aren't embracing this step nine, that you hear all these things that are kind of anti-step nine. And I'll tell you what I mean. It said, if we, this is just down the second paragraph, it said, if we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. How many of you hear that in meetings? All you got to do is stop drinking. Put your hand up. So that's a load of lies. That's coming out of selfish people's mouths. Now, don't beat me up. I'm only reading out of this book. It tell you down here. It says this. Certainly, he must keep sober. We're not knocking you for staying sober. For there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to his wife or parents, whom for years he has shockingly treated. Now, I don't hear a lot of people talking about this. Some I do, but not a lot. Passing all understanding is the patience of mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Now, again, I'm acutely aware of this, because I spend a fair bit of my time talking to people, families of alcoholics and addicts. And you really, really do start empathizing with the traumatic pain that somebody's mother is experiencing, that their father, that their spouse, that their children are experiencing why they've got this alcoholic in their life or addict. It's truly, truly sustained, complex trauma. Complex trauma means it's sustained trauma. It's not just a little bit of trauma. It's sustained trauma over a long period of time. So if people in recovery think they got trauma and PTSD, so are their families. It's traumatic having an alcoholic in your life that you love. It says, passing all understanding, had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today or perhaps be dead. And I'm not trying to say this to give anyone a beating. I really just want to strongly highlight something that seems to be extremely missing. But if we can get on this, you can end up in a fantastic quality of recovery. So you can have a really bad quality of recovery, because we see that a lot. But you can have a really good quality of recovery if you're willing to face some of this stuff. He said the alcoholic is like a tornado. I mean, that is a pretty big statement, but it's true. It's like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil over years. Years. Children have been brought up in that. We feel a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough. So when you hear in the meeting people saying being sober is enough, why aren't they happy? Because I'm sober. That's unthinking. And I wrote down the definition of unthinking. It says acting without prior consideration of the consequences. It's selfish. It says he is like the farmer who come up from the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarks, don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? So, you know, think about that picture there. It's saying that, you know, that there's a tornado that's completely trashed your house, your garden, your street. And you've come out of the root cellar, which is sort of you've sobered up. And now you're not drinking. Everybody's living in this devastation. And you're like, well, ain't it good that the tornado's over? Well, of course, that's true. But then we've got to be able to acknowledge the devastation. But it's saying the alcoholic who's self-centered to the extreme doesn't care to do that. That we still carry on being selfish and still trying to get them to meet our needs. Now, again, this is part of a mental illness. And so you shouldn't be beating yourself up for that. But if we start to accept it, we can begin to change it. Because look, you cannot change what you can't accept. That's one of the foundational principles in the universe. You can't change what you don't accept. So it says, yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. See, there's another must. There's no must in this program, but there's another must that it says there. So you can understand that, can't you? That you've got this, you're drinking yourself to death. You've got this incredibly intense bad feeling inside yourself, which is called your conscience. You're poisoning your body. You're behaving totally against your own conscience. You're upsetting everybody around you, which, you know, there's every good reason they should be upset. Because they just want it to stop. And we're totally anaesthetizing ourselves to try and stop the bad feeling. We're stuck in that place. So when we come out of that, what's going to actually make you feel better and start really dealing with easing that conscience is starting to the reconstruction. And so the fourth step is almost like a business plan. You know, when it says you're liking yourself to a shop, that you're actually taking infantry. We're taking infantry of the destruction. And then we're going to start to reconstruct it, and we're going to stop destroying, and we're going to start creating. And as we start creating, everybody's going to get happy, because that's all they ever wanted. It's a stop. One thing I learned, and I tell people a lot, everybody just wants to have a nice day. Just today. But again, if I've got all of this guilt and shame and remorse from the past that's clouding my conscience, then today's not going to be good. Because I'm going to be super sensitive. But when I clear away the wreckage of my past, and like it says in the step 10, and then continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I promptly admitted it. I'm wrong. Wrong today. But I managed to realize I'm wrong and said, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. And then I can change the state of being. But again, it's not always easy to do that. But again, the more you practice, the better you get at it. So is saying we must take the lead. Because remember, your families have been living in this destruction as well, and most of them haven't got a program. And again, that's a shocking thing that hopefully we're going to get to before we clock off. He said, a remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. We ought to sit down. I mean, even some people make amends. They go and read this card to you. And it is, to me, it's like a remorseful mumbling, reading that card to people. Now, again, sorry to judge anyone who actually done that, but I don't think that's amends. Because, you know, a few years ago, somebody was walking up Lowestoft High Street, minding my own business. Somebody jumped out of a alleyway. I don't think they were waiting for me. They just see me and they come running up to me and started reading that card about how they were resentful at me and they regretted it. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. What? Again, because I don't believe that's actually making amends. I don't want you to get off that lightly. I said, well, hang on a minute. You just jump out there. Now, I'm full of anxiety because all of a sudden you're telling me that you resent me and that you owe me this amends. I don't even know what you've done to me. And now I'm full of all this anxiety because I don't know what you've did and I'm not sure what's going on here. And I know you're trying to relieve yourself on me, which is paramount to something I won't say the word. But once you've relieved yourself on me, I'm going to have to wipe that shit off, emotionally speaking. So I said, what have you done to me? He said, well, I've been slagging you off. I'm like, well, where you been slagging me off? He said, oh, all over Norwich. I said, well, do you think reading that card to me and telling me that you're sorry for slagging me off is making an amends? He went, yeah. I said, no, it ain't. I said, making amends, you need to go to Norwich and tell everyone that you were sorry for slagging me off and that you didn't mean it. That's making an amends, not reading a bloody card. If you kick my fence down, telling me you're sorry for kicking my fence down, I don't care about that. I want you to pay for the money to put the fence back. If you nicked money off me 20 years ago, I want my money back and interest. That's making amends, and we're going to talk about that on Saturday, creative amends. But also in the family. We'll get a bit more to that. So it said, we ought to sit down with the family. Now, I don't know if this actually happens. I question people, and I've not really heard this happening very often. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. And the people that I know that are working the program, but again, it doesn't seem like a massive majority. They don't do this. It says we ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyse the past. See, when we do our workshops, we say, look, we send you a questionnaire and say we want you to go and speak to three closest people in your life and ask them some questions. We want you to go and get your wife to do your infantry for you. We want your husband to do your infantry. Go and ask them what's wrong with you. And again, you can see that some people may have a problem doing that. But if you can't do that, you're dysfunctional. If you're in a relationship and you can't go and speak to your spouse or partner and ask them what's wrong with you and sit and listen and sort it out, if it just comes down to they keep going on at you and you keep telling them to piss off or leave me alone, you're dysfunctional. There's something wrong with you. So we ask, go and ask your spouses, even your children, go and ask your children, how can I be a better father? How can I be a better mother? I'm sure they tell you. I'm sure they know exactly what you need to do. And why wouldn't you want to know that? Why wouldn't you stop every now and then with your spouse and say, am I doing anything that's annoying or anything that's wrong or anything that's upsetting you? Why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you know that? Why wouldn't they be able to tell you that? Without you chewing them another arsehole. Because you're dysfunctional. And you're not going to have good relationships until you learn to do that. And that's never going to happen until you write the big pile of problems down and start working on them like this program suggests. Again, you can have a go at me, but this is what I'm reading I don't know what you're reading, if it ain't the same as what I'm reading. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill because we're trying to do reconstruction. See, it's that one shoe. You're not going to reconstruct your mind or your ability to have better relationships until you start practicing. Forgiveness doesn't make you not dysfunctional. Forgiveness just gives you, takes away hopefully the pain so you can begin to redevelop and reconstruct your neural net to build better pathways for you and your family to enjoy more pleasant versions of the reality that already exists. But unless you build the matter, the mind can't exist. So we have to practice this. It says we ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past. Now we see, before we begin, we be very careful not to criticize them. So I guess you can all say that none of you have been criticizing your family. It's hard for me, and don't get me wrong, I'm not talking, I know I sound like it, but I'm not talking from a spiritual hilltop. I'm trying to practice this myself. And this is hitting me. If it's hitting you, it's hitting me as well. I promise you. It says their defects may be glaring, and they usually are. It says the world and the people were quite often wrong. But that's as far as we're getting. The infantry was ours, not theirs. And see, when we do that with people, I started that some years ago with people that had been around a while and they're not getting on so good. I said, look, mate, I need you to go and ask your wife to do your infantry for you. And they'd be like, what? I said, I want you to go and ask your wife to do your infantry. Go and ask your wife to do a list of things that are wrong with you. The things that you're not listening to. Because she's trying to tell you. Because your life is trying to give you feedback. But see, when you're hurt, you don't want the feedback because it hurts. And so you've not got a very good mirror. Your life is constantly telling you what's wrong. That's what your conscience is. It's constantly giving you feedback. People are telling you. Your wife's going, why don't you listen? Why don't you do this? Pick up your fucking socks. Your children are telling you. But if you don't know how to listen, see, look, that's my biggest thing I've learned with people with addiction problem. That they hear, but they do not understand. They're not decoding their feedback very well. They think that they're hearing, but they're not understanding. So your life is talking to you, but you've been dumbed down. And so you do appear like a bit of a psychopath. But really, it's not because you are a psychopath. It's because your conscience has been dumbed down. By drugs, by alcohol, by behavior, by avoidance, by underdevelopment. And so this is starting that process again. It says their defects may be glaring, but the chances are our own actions are partly responsible. So when the people come back with their list and their wife writes 10 things on the list, and you look at the list and you say, mate, look, is any of them 10 things unreasonable? And usually, you know, there's only exact figures, but just to give you an idea, that they probably go, well, I think them two are a bit unreasonable. And I'm like, you know what? I agree with you. Them two things are a bit unreasonable, but the other eight seem pretty reasonable to me. How long have you been having an argument about that one? Oh, about 10 years. How long have you been having an argument about that one? About 15 years. He's like, well, your program now is to change that. To change all of that. That should have been your program. And they go away and they start to work on making them changes. And then they come back after a short period and he's like, it's a miracle. It's amazing. Everything's just changed. It's amazing. It's amazing. And he's like, yeah. What about them other two things? They go, what two things? I said, them other two unreasonable things. Yes, you ain't doing them anymore. So even the unreasonable things, we're partly responsible. Now, look, we're not completely responsible for them, but We are responsible for us. When we change the way we're responding, other people change. So again, here's another lie that you hear around the fellowship. That you can't change people, places, things and situations. Bullshit. If that was true, there'd be no point in doing the step nine. I promise you, when you start to change your ways, other people will change around you. And even things that you can't even make the connection will start changing in your life and happening that never happened before. And you will not be able to see, man, I've been wanting that to happen for the last 20 years. And I never actually did anything to make that happen. But when I changed, it just all of a sudden happened. There's a lot more going on than meets the eye. It says, so we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. See, that actually matches the on awakening, as you see. Like, again, when you go through this book, you'll start seeing the whole book starts tying together and it becomes a very simple process. But this whole book is a very simple process. It just has to be laid out in the way it is, because we live in this linear sort of time. But as we study it, it becomes a very simple process. But we have to practice it for that to happen. And so it says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It says unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual expresses a desire to live on spiritual principles, we ought not to urge them. We should think, we should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than any other words. So, you know, when you're new, you kind of might get a bit excited, but you know, it is important to invite your family in, especially your spouse, into your morning meditation, and to even do the, you know, to write your list together as well. You can do that and do your visualizations together and things like that. I mean, it is an incredible practice. We do that. We do that in business. You know, when we have a manager's meeting, it's the same thing. We're trying to get a group conscience. We set an idea and then we sort of brainstorm. And then as we're brainstorming, everybody's having an imagination of what possibly could happen, and they're bringing their skill and their experience to the table, and eventually we come on an outcome, and then we all move in that direction. I mean, to a degree, we're already kind of doing this. I mean, you know, just a lot of the time, we're doing it in a very negative way, not a positive way, or we're not conscious of it. And so, you know, we're shooting in the dark a little bit more. It says, and so, you know, if we just carry on the behavior, you know, like we were saying the other day about the person saying that their family didn't trust them, but it's like, well, they will start trusting you when you start giving them money, when you start cutting their grass, when you start turning up to help them, when you start noticing them, when you start caring about them, when they said something to you and you actually heard them and responded to it. They might be saying, oh, you know, I really like this new pair of garden shears. I've seen them in this magazine. And, you know, and then for their birthday, you turn up with the garden shears. And they're like, my God, they were listening to me. They weren't just going on about themselves. That people start noticing that you're becoming conscious of them, not just yourself. And then you start helping them with their life, which is kind of what you'd be kind of wanting to do anyway, I should think. It says, we must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can be honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. So these are all instructions in the step nine. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl to anybody. Now, there could be an argument made here that when it's coming now to the promises, that we say again that when before we're halfway through. Now, we say step nine, but again, that step nine can be reduced to just a number instead of when we're halfway through making effort to put things right with our mothers, with our fathers, with our friends, with our family, when we're halfway through repairing the damage done to our children, repairing and certain other aspects of our life. You could say when we are painstaking about this phase, and it could be this phase that it's talking about putting things right with our families, that we should be making amends to them in this way as soon as we can. It says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom. I'm going to stop there. If you got, you can have a chat. But if you've got some questions around this, please bring them to the meeting tomorrow. And because this is a deep subject, it can go on for years to get a good understanding of this. But this is barely but a beginning. But it is only a it's a good beginning if it's honestly made. So I'll leave it there and I'll let you guys give some feedback.
Morning. Thanks, Lester. Yeah, I've written notes again, to be honest with you. But something I've written down here was, obviously, I got up to step nine when I was in ECR. My mum was top of my list with resentments because I can't stand arguing with her, and that's all we ever used to do, especially when we drank and she drinks. And so when I come out, the first person I went to see was my mum, and we sat down, and I look back now and I think all I did was told her I didn't want to argue with her anymore. But what I've got out today is, the reality is we didn't actually discuss what makes us argue. Because until we actually realise what it was that caused us arguing in the first place, we never actually... So I've not... Effectively, I've taken a step towards it. And that's just fear, as you say. You know, I don't want to hurt her either as well. But also, it's my own fear of my own behaviour, I think. So anyway, I'm doing my step four and step five again with my new sponsor this weekend. And of course, she's top of my list again. So today's been amazing for me because now it gives me a couple of days to really sit down and look at what has caused that resentment, what we're arguing about, so I can get to the, hopefully that's what I've got out of today anyway. What was my part in what's caused the argument? The things, anything what we've argued about, silly little things that I know in myself, and maybe that will help me get to the root of what the problem is so I can make a proper amends to her. I don't know if I've got that right or not, but that's really what I've got out of today, so I really appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I was just saying it's our 15-year wedding anniversary today. So the first 2 years of marriage was fun. 6 years were shit. The first 2 years in recovery were pretty shit. And then it started healing the relationship. And the one thing that I did with hubby was, with the recommendation from ECR, was we had therapy, and that therapy lasted around about 10 months. And I remember the therapist putting on the board relationship, and she said, you two aren't in a relationship, you're on a battleship. And what was the other thing? She told me to shut the fuck up with my recovery language. And then she saw him on his own a couple of times. So it was quite interesting. And then I think I picked up on your point about we stop caring, you know, the things that agitate us, we stop caring. But it's funny because I always have this dilemma, and maybe I'll come back on tomorrow to ask you the question. But I think mostly I've stopped caring about stuff. Or little stuff or big stuff. And I think I had this conversation with him a couple of years ago, and I said, if you died, it wouldn't devastate me. I said, it wouldn't floor me like things have in the past. I said, I'd be very sad, but I wouldn't be devastated. And then I think it was 2 years ago, actually, in April, you did a workshop that I came to. And he found it really difficult to make that list of inventory for me. And because he said, I didn't take criticism very well. So actually, this is my list. I've still got it. So I do look at this stuff and think, am I changing? Have I changed? Not always an easy journey, but I think I've definitely changed from this list. So maybe it's time for another list from him. But no, thanks for your talk. Really useful today. And I'll be back on tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you, Belle.
Just with the men's, yeah, how long would you suggest a direct to men should take, right, when you're doing it? And also, what if, right, once you've made that direct amends, and it's been accepted, that the people, like the family members, keep like dragging up that old stuff, you know, in the future. Do you know what I mean? You know, if they keep like, well, this, you were doing this when you were, do you know what I mean? What would you suggest you do in that sort of situation?
Well, again, I think if I'm understanding, is like, remember, like, because we're kind of like selfish, and we're like, when I say sorry, you accept it, and then you don't give me any more shit because it don't make me feel comfortable. That's the selfishness that we're looking for. It's saying it's years of reconstruction. So I quite like it in the Bible where they ask Jesus, how many times should I forgive my brother or mother or whoever? And he says 7 times 77, which means kind of constantly. So that's what I'm saying. You know, when you've forgiven them, when they carry on being an arsehole, but you don't feel anything other than compassion for them. So that shows that you really haven't forgiven them, that you haven't really made the amends. If so, still your infantry should be yours, not theirs. It's your response that you should be looking at. If they're saying that and you're still responding in a negative or hurt, you're getting hurt, then you've not healed either.
Okay, yeah, no worries.
It's quite deep, isn't it?
Yeah.
But again, this is the bit people don't know. They think I should just go around saying sorry to everyone. Sorry that I've been ruining your life for 20 years and had 5 affairs. Well, don't know what's wrong with her. Don't know why she keeps getting the arms just because I come home late. What's wrong? I don't know why she keeps going. Honestly, it takes a long time to learn to stop being selfish.
Yeah, thanks, Lester, for that. I think when I first made amends, like especially to my mum, it was sort of like one of those mumbling apologies. And I think through doing your group on dysfunction, I've realised just how dysfunctional I am. And I think even though it's been very painful and pretty deep, what it's done is it's given me a bit of an understanding, and I know it's ongoing. And I think what I'm trying to do now is do my creative amends without being selfish to her. And I know I've got still got a lot of growing to do. But, just want to say thank you for that, Lester. I've got a lot out of it.
Thank you. Yeah, Tuesday group that we do, we might, I'm hoping to expand that. That was like, honestly, was like my first step into actually starting to do sort of groups that focus on dysfunction. And the goal is the first step is to convince people that are dysfunctional. I'm only talking to the dysfunctional ones. Those of you that aren't or don't think you are, I'm not talking to you. But the ones who actually are willing to admit that they may be somewhat dysfunctional, it's quite a difficult journey, and it takes a fair bit of time to convince you that you're dysfunctional, because most of us don't really know what it is. So it takes time sitting in a group where we're talking about it, and it is quite uncomfortable, and it goes through uncomfortable stages to get you to realise that you are dysfunctional. And then the next sort of phase is then starting to get you to see how that's actually playing out in your life. And then like the third stage is then to try to get you to understand strategies that you can then start applying to your life to start doing the reconstruction. You know, it's all right saying, if I smash somebody's house up, I've got to build them a new house. But if you've never built a house before, you're going to need to learn how to do that. And that's going to take some time. And it's the same with relationships and emotions. If you've come from a very dysfunctional background, it's nothing to do with addiction. addiction and dysfunction are not the same thing. People with addiction can behave very dysfunctionally, but a lot of them that haven't got the dysfunction problem, they deal with addiction, they just get on. But having an addiction and dysfunction are two different things, and it makes it worse. Addiction is a lot worse when you've got dysfunction, and dysfunction's a lot worse when you've got addiction. But addiction's a lot easier to treat than dysfunction. But we don't tend to treat dysfunction. And we don't seem to understand what it is. That's one thing. So even this book, I just grabbed this book from the centre. I've had it for a long time. And it says adult children. But you can see it said adult children. And they've even wrote The Secrets of Dysfunctional Families. See, so dysfunction is very secretive. It's very hard to identify. So unless you go on workshops and read books like this, you're just not going to know what it is if you are dysfunctional, if you're not going to go to therapists. And believe me, we employ a lot of therapists over the years, and a lot of them are dysfunctional. They don't know they're dysfunctional. Eleanor's not one of them. Eleanor's got a good understanding of this for a therapist. And hopefully in the future, we're going to do some online groups and you can join in them groups with Eleanor. We're talking about how we can make that happen now. We're going to make it so it's cheap, or not cheap, but not inexpensive, where a group of you can actually go on a course with Eleanor and myself and start learning about some of this stuff. But it takes a lot of courage to face this stuff, because when you stop becoming dysfunctional and your family is still dysfunctional, they're not going to know how to respond. And the program is about teaching us that we're supposed to carry this back. The real purpose is that we carry this message back to our families. But if we don't know that, we don't do it. We think it's about us. We keep thinking this is about us. This is an altruistic movement. You're going to help yourself by helping them. And it becomes, you're like, wow, I used to be the last person anybody called in my family. Now I'm the first person. And so it's so important to learn, and it's so wonderful. And that's why I want to share it with everyone. But we're working on it, so stick with us and try and open up and try and learn. But at the minute, you don't need this book. You need to do what's in this book. This is brilliant. It's fantastic. And I learned that myself more and more this morning. I read it and it's like, oh, this is just so wonderful. And I'm learning things myself rereading it.